In our local view, he's the fine columnist for the Register Guard. Catch his work on the cover of the sports section online, registerguard.com, on Twitter, at Austin Meek RG. Austin, how's it going?
Good, Steve. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So, our pre-tournament chat, you called Michigan, who I'm going to forever kick myself for overlooking. You got Nova. You went Michigan State in the Midwest. Everybody, you jumped on the wrong Virginia bandwagon. And I'll tell you, getting two correct kind of skyrockets you well up the list. So you're saying, though, when you filled out your actual bracket, you made a change in the Michigan bracket?
Yeah, I think the lesson here is I should always go with my gut, because when I start thinking, that's when things go wrong. When thinking comes into the equation, I find a way to screw it up. Because after I took Michigan on your show, then I sat down to do my bracket, and I literally thought, you know, I got Michigan and Michigan State in the Final Four. They're not both going to get there. So, of course, I took away the wrong one. I kept Michigan State, and I subbed out Michigan for North Carolina. Suffice it to say, I have not been part of the race in my bracket pool. I was eliminated pretty early.
Well, in case it ever comes down to a legality and people are doubting that you ever really thought it was going to be Michigan, I mean, we've got it all archived.
We have it on tape.
So we could provide the audio evidence if need be. You know, that final game of the Elite Eight to decide who went to San Antonio, Duke and Kansas, Grayson Allen almost pulled a Leitner and, you know, put the Blue Devils into the Final Four with a buzzer beater. Then, of course, the Malik Newman show in overtime. So while Maryland-Baltimore County or Loyola-Chicago are great stories, you know, isn't there a nice touch to a couple of true heavyweights just going toe-to-toe with the season on the line?
Yeah, I think a great tournament needs both. It needs the Cinderella story. It needs a team like Loyola Chicago or UMBC. But it also needs some really high-level games between two blue bloods. And that's kind of what we've been missing in this tournament until that Duke and Kansas game, which was as good as any tournament game that I've watched in the last few years, for sure. Just two really good teams trading punches. You know, I think I heard something crazy, like neither team was ahead by, the gap was never big, but larger than like 6 points in regulation. You know, just a back and forth game, a really fun high level game. I'll admit, I was kind of on the skeptical side of Kansas. I'd watched that team bow out of the tournament early a few times the last few years, but they put it together when it counted and got Bill Self back to the Final Four.
Yeah, that was a weird season for them. I don't think they have that high lottery pick. There was a point during the middle of the conference season where it was like, uh-oh, that run of then 13 in a row is over. And I guess that's the best part of the tournament, the irony of all those years of Kansas making the Final Four. It would be this year.
Yeah, I admit, I thought this was the weakest Kansas team I'd seen in a while back in January or February. They lost a couple games at home, and I just wasn't seeing it with this team. But, you know, that's kind of been Bill Self's pattern, though. When he goes into the tournament with a team that everybody thinks is going to win it all, sometimes he loses early, but then he goes in with a team that maybe people aren't talking about quite as much and finds a way to get to the Final Four, which is, you know, it's just one of the things that makes this an interesting tournament.
So we end up with an 11. That happened 7 years ago, Virginia Commonwealth. And in that was the same year Butler made it back. George Mason was an 11, 2006. But this Loyola of Chicago team, who did catch a break, you know, they ended up playing a 7 seed in Nevada and a 9 in Kansas State. And those other teams, the so-called Cinderellas, got bounced in the national semis. What kind of shot you give them against Michigan, and is using a nearly 100-year-old nun cheating?
I think in college sports, you can invoke whoever or whatever gives you an edge. So I saw already Jay Wright is trying to claim the Pope. which, if anything is going to trump the nun, I guess it's going to be the Pope. So whatever you got on your side, you got to use it. I do love the nun. It's great. I think Sister Jean alone has been the best part of this tournament. You know, I think the pattern tends to be for a team like this, and I felt this way last year with Oregon, even though Oregon wasn't, you know, a dark horse in the same way that Loyola is. When you're going through the first two weekends of the tournament, it's still recognizable from the kinds of games that you play during the regular season. It still feels, it's different, but it's not that different. But then when you get to the Final Four, the whole magnitude of everything changes. You know, instead of playing in a basketball arena, you're playing in a massive stadium.
Right.
It's cavernous. You know, there's more fans, there's more media, everything gets multiplied. So I typically am not very high on the Cinderella team if they get all the way to the Final Four. I think that's when it starts to hit you. So I'm not expecting Loyola to beat Michigan, but I didn't expect them to win really any of these games after the first round. So who knows? Who knows?
I wish I knew. I'd be sitting having this conversation with you in my mansion in Vegas on my own sports station. Talking with Austin Meek of the Register Guard. So I see you're moonlighting now as a magazine writer.
Yeah, once in a while. It's nice to get outside of sports a little bit. You know, sports is still the bread and butter, but there's other stuff in life that I enjoy once in a while, yeah.
Yeah, I saw you. Well, we've talked, you're a music lover. You play a little guitar. So, you know, me being clueless, it's ridiculous that I moved here 28 years ago to work for a music station. I used to know as much about music as I did about sports. Now I don't know anything. But so this artist you covered, and from what I've read, I mean, let's face it, we live in a time now where it's like battle lines are drawn, politics, society, everybody's miserable. You found somebody who actually wakes up every day with hope?
I guess you could say that. You know, I'm a big music fan. I have kind of weird and eclectic music taste. And I'm a believer that, you know, music is a way that we kind of transmit culture or ideas.
Sure.
And I'm a fan of music that I think taps into something bigger than just, you know, the present moment. Music that's, I guess you could say, a little bit timeless, you know, that draws on some themes that go beyond just the here and now. So anyway, I wrote this essay that got picked up about this band that I feel like accomplishes some of those things. So it is on my Twitter feed if anybody wants to read it.
Yeah, that's where I caught it. So next up, this project to renovate Hayward Field to host the 2021 World Outdoors. And apparently the U of O had decided on a design that was satisfactory to many, but then others who have some clout were not on board. So I guess from the basics, what is that plan, and who might not be in favor of it?
Well, it's been quite a saga getting to the bottom of what's going to happen to Hayward Field, because remember, the project was supposed to be done by now. There's
right.
supposed to be a new stadium there right now, and they've not moved a shovel full of dirt from the site. So it's really gotten delayed and bogged down from what originally was planned, and I think the gist of it is that it's been really hard to find a design and a vision for the stadium that's going to satisfy the major stakeholders, which include the IAAF, which has certain requirements that you have to meet to host the World Championship. That includes the hardcore track crowd in Eugene, which is strong, you know, and a passionate group of fans in Eugene, and it also includes the people who give the money to build the stadium, which is Phil Knight, is number one on that list. So getting all those folks together has been a difficult task. They do have a design now. A lot of people have not seen it. It will be released sometime next month, as I understand, and I think when people do see it, some people may be a little bit surprised about the scale of it and how drastic the change is going to be, because initially, I think the way the project was pitched was that it was going to preserve a lot of the history of Hayward Field, and I don't think that's ultimately going to be the case. I think it's going to look very, very different from what is there now. And there's some people who have kind of mixed feelings about that, or strong feelings that they don't want it to change. So I don't think we've quite heard the last of this.
That I would doubt. Continue a few final thoughts of all for Austin Meek of the Register Guard. So Thursday is opening day. And for most of my life, your entire life, you've had to get clarification. Did it mean that it was the ESPN standalone game? But for the first time in 50 years, there's actually opening day. Everybody plays, and that kicks off the season. I think it's an awesome idea, and I can't believe it's been so long. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it kind of has a nice ring to it.
Yeah.
Opening day. You know, given people a full slate of games, it kind of feels right to me. You know, I didn't necessarily hate the standalone Sunday night games we used to get to open the season. It was okay, but if it wasn't your team playing in that game, then it was kind of anticlimactic because then you had to wait a few days for your team to start playing. Here, everybody starts from the same place. It's a shotgun start. Nobody has to sit and wait around. So I kind of like it.
A shotgun start. I like that one. So last night, the run by the Oregon women ended in Spokane. Again in the Elite Eight. A year ago, it was against that UConn beast. This season, Notre Dame. And as historic and magnificent as this year was, is it logical to think it was a disappointing finish? Because that second half, that normally the way they finished, that was really not their best foot forward.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think they played their best game. And I don't know if their best game would have beaten Notre Dame. It certainly would have been closer than the final margin, which I think was 10 points.
Yep.
Especially in that second half. I think Oregon has to look at the fact that they were ahead at halftime. They had a lot of momentum. And then the third quarter, the wheels just started to fall off. They didn't shoot the ball especially well. They didn't rebound the ball very well at all. So I think there will be some things when they look back at this game over the off season. That really motivate them going into next year. I think Oregon was good enough to play in the Final Four this year. I'll frankly be surprised if they're not in the Final Four next year because almost everybody comes back, and I think they're going to be an even better team next year than they were this year. Part of getting to that point is going through some heartbreak. That's a hard thing to hear, especially in the moment. Everybody's disappointed. But when you look at the teams that get there, sometimes you got to go through a year or two of being really close because that is what motivates you to get that extra edge that you need to get there. So disappointing ending, I guess, but hard to say the season as a whole was anything but a big step forward for the program.
Yeah, well, last year, you know, you go under 500 in league, and it's like, how the heck did they get there? This year, you end in the same round, and it's like, man, can't believe they didn't get there. But like you said, who they're bringing back, plus a couple of talented recruits, ironically, a Notre Dame transfer. So are we comfortable saying, after a great run and a great season, that for now in the immediate future, that they've pulled alongside Stanford and I guess UCLA as, you know, the big three in this league, and this might be something to get used to.
Yeah, well, and don't forget Oregon State, which,
oh, that's,
you know,
true.
To get back to the Elite Eight this year,
my bad.
Oregon State, I think, was a really significant step because this was kind of a rebuilding year for them. So, yeah, I think those four programs that you mentioned, UCLA, Stanford, Oregon, and Oregon State, have separated themselves in the Pac-12. And I think Oregon and Oregon State going into next year may be 1-2. I don't know what Stanford has coming back. I don't know for sure what UCLA has. But I know what Oregon has, and I've got a pretty good feel for what Oregon State has. Those two teams are going to be really good. So I think the question now for Oregon is, can you consistently get into that sort of second tier of women's basketball programs? Because there's UConn, and then there's everybody else. And nobody's really in the class with UConn or even close to being in the class with UConn. But there's a group of programs that are in that second tier that are consistent Elite Eight, Final Four caliber programs. I think Oregon can get there, but this year showed that they still have a little ways to go before they can say they're in that same class.
Yeah, just for the record, Jordan Canada and Monique Billings were seniors for UCLA. So obviously that's a monster hit. That would be like Oregon losing Sabrina and Ruthie. And Stanford, yeah. I think Brittany McPhee, the one who scored 80,000 points in that half, I think she was also a senior. So yeah, right. No, that's a great point.
Could be Oregon State next year, 1-2. Civil War for the Pac-12 title. That could be fun.
Yeah, that sounds fun. All right, Austin, always a lot of fun. Enjoy the rest of your week, and I'm sure something will surface that we'll look forward to chatting about next Tuesday.
All righty. Sounds good. Thanks, Steve.
All right, take it easy.